I'd like to read from Srimad Bhagavatam this afternoon. From chapter 17, which is Punishment and Reward of Kali. And the section of chapter 17 that we will be discussing, is the dialogue between Maharaj Parikshit and the bull. And Maharaj Parikshit has asked the bull a question, and the bull is giving an answer, and Maharaj Parikshit is appreciating how profound his answer is. There's two main parts of this dialogue that we'll be speaking about. One is understanding what's the cause of one's suffering. And another is, how does one who's on the receiving end of suffering, how do they view the instrument of that suffering? Or how do they avoid getting implicated in the network of nescience by not properly understanding the instrument of their suffering? It's practical, and because this topic is a topic that people may speak about from time to time. When you're hearing this topic from the Srimad Bhagavatam, anticipate that it's going to go to a deeper level than you're accustomed to hearing, so we have to be attentive to pick up on where the Bhagavatam wants to take us in terms of consciousness. It's profound. So, the scene of chapter 17, the beginning of the chapter, Maharaj Parikshit is in his palace, ruling his kingdom that's flourishing very nicely. He's functioning as an ideal king. He's very happy, his citizens are very happy, everything is very prosperous. There's no sinful activity in his whole kingdom. It's like, it just doesn't happen. Not something to regulate or control, it's just, it's very wonderful. And then suddenly, but describes like that, and then suddenly he gets a report. There's sinful activity in your kingdom. Very heinous sinful activity in your kingdom. There's a low-class person dressed up like a high-class person, like a king, with a crown and ornaments of a king and the dress of a king. He's pretending to be a king, but he's behaving in a very low-class way. That the particular low-class thing that he's doing is, he's got a club in his hand and he's breaking the legs of a bull in a public place. Just smashing the legs of a bull. And when Maharaj Parikshit receives this word, he's very angry, and he's also very happy. Happy in the sense that a kshatriya likes to fight, like an athlete likes sports competition. Here's some good opponent for sports competition. Yay! He's excited. Happy. But very unhappy that this is going on in my kingdom. This never goes on in my kingdom. At once, summon my entire army. We're going to put a stop to this at once. He doesn't need a whole army, but he brings his whole army. Elephants and chariots and soldiers and infantry and air force and space missiles. No, he didn't. Have those yet. So, he goes marching with his army towards the place. And en route, because he's the emperor, there are kingdoms that are under his rule, and he stops at different palaces of those different kingdoms, and he's received with great honor because he's the emperor. And there's a certain group of brahmanas that are reciters of histories. Our English term is bards. They're skilled in reciting in choice poetry the histories of various dynasties and exalted kings, and appropriate for Maharaj Pariksit is to hear about the Pandavas. They're his ancestors. And they're the kings just immediately prior to him. So when he hears, just like in the 7th chapter of this first canto, the hearing of the activities of the Pandavas is Krishna Katha, because it's all in relation to Krishna. Because the Pandavas have no interest in doing anything, thinking anything, eating anything, going anywhere outside of Krishna. So it's anything in relation to the Pandavas is Krishna Katha. And as he's hearing the Krishna Katha from these very qualified reciters, he's literally in ecstasy. It's quite a contrast. He's on his way, he's on a mission to kill, and he's in transcendental ecstasy, hearing Krishna Katha. He's just stunned. His body is trembling, and his hairs are standing on end, and tears are streaming from his eyes, hearing these wonderful descriptions of Krishna Katha. He's on this very high platform of Krishna consciousness. At the same time, he's prepared to do his duty. It's like Krishna describes in Bhagavad Gita to Arjuna. Perform your prescribed duty and always think of me. So how do we and always think of him? By the same method as Maharaj Pariksit is always thinking of him, by hearing. Of course, hearing, when you're attached to someone, hearing about that someone enhances your emotion in relation to that someone. Supposing you're trying to become attached to Krishna. So just hearing about Krishna also helps one clear away obstacles and become attached to Krishna, so that as you become more mature in Krishna consciousness, hearing just sends you further and further and further and further, and there's no limit of furtherness to happiness, joy, ecstasy in relation to Krishna by hearing. So he's hearing with great happiness. And then after some days, he comes to the scene. And the scene is, there's the man, this low-class person, very dark in complexion, obviously of low character, but dressed in an imitation king's garb, with a club in his hand, smashing the legs of a bull. So, being a suitable king, there wasn't the checks and balances system that we have today. The checks and balances system means there's the executive branch of government, but then there's also the legislative branch of government and the judicial branch of government, because supposing the executive branch is an abusive person, he has all this power and he's not pure. He can use that power in a dangerous way, corrupt way, and hurtful way. And because history showed, as Kali Yuga progressed, persons weren't qualified. They had to check this guy that was in the executive position. But at the time of Maharaj Pariksit, there wasn't a check system. He was it. So right on the spot, he was judge and jury, and the executor of the decision. He held a little trial. It was fair. He first asked, it's obvious what was going on. I mean, he saw it. It wasn't like he heard it, but it's not true, because somebody reported it falsely. He saw it. But he still asked, my dear victim over here, Mr. Bull, who has done this to you? Fair trial. What's the cause of your suffering? And being not just a bull, but Dharma personified, had difficulty giving him a direct answer. I'll read text 18 and 19 first. O greatest among human beings, it is very difficult to ascertain the particular miscreant who has caused our sufferings, because we are bewildered by all the different opinions of theoretical philosophers. Some of the philosophers who deny all sorts of duality declare that one's own self is responsible for his personal happiness and distress. There's even a verse in Bhagavad Gita like that. Yes? Purusha prakriti stohi bhunte prakriti janganan karanam guna sadngosya sad asad yoni janmasu. We're responsible for our own happiness and distress. Sad asad yoni janmasu. We're responsible. We can't blame somebody else. What's the cause of my distress? I am. I made certain choices with my free will, and now I'm implicated in the happiness and distress of those choices. Others say that superhuman powers are responsible. I'm not to blame, and he's not to blame. It's just some higher power is making some decision here. What can I do? We're victims of these higher powers that are deciding things. Well, yet others say that activity is responsible. Karma. I'm just on this conveyor belt, and destiny is forcing this and that to happen. What can I do? It's destiny. Sorry, Your Honor, I'm sorry I punched this guy in the nose, but it was just destiny. What can I do? And the gross materialists maintain that nature is the ultimate cause. Like that, so the karma of the monks are philosophers. As the karma idea or work, activity. So because activity is responsible for our happiness and our distress, do good activity, you get happiness. And avoid bad activity, and you get happiness. So just do good works. You don't need to worry about some higher authority. Because if there is some higher authority, they're under the law of karma anyways. Whether there is or there isn't, it doesn't matter. You, if you like, you can worship someone, that's okay. But they're under the law of karma, so do good works, whatever you do. Worship, don't worship. Just do good works. And then those that administer the outcome of good or bad works, they're just bound by that law of karma, so that's supreme. Or material nature. That's another. There's inherent properties and laws of matter. It's not just modern science. Modern science is a spin on a very old atheistic philosophy that says there's properties of matter, and that's every, there's matter and the properties, the laws governing matter, and that's all there is. There's nothing else. Anything that you might say and describe some other way, wrong. Because the only thing that is matter and the laws governing matter. That's all there is. It's like mechanistic science all the way. It's not a new twist, not a new dance. It's an old one. Atomic theory, Gautama, Rishi. There are sad darshans, or six philosophical doctrines that are surprisingly or not surprisingly, maybe surprisingly, they're derived from the Vedas, You aware of that? Like, you know, the modern scientists don't even bother with the Vedas, but the previous philosophers, they studied the Vedas. And by their study of the Vedas, they came out with these different doctrines, karma mimamsa philosophy and Gotama's atom, and the properties of matter philosophy, and the demigods philosophy, and it's astrological influences that are acting upon us. What can I do? I just have my destiny here. So there's different ideas. The bull is responding. There are even some thinkers who believe that no one can ascertain the cause of distress by argumentation, nor know it by imagination, nor express it by words. Even if you knew it, you couldn't say it. It's so elusive and so subtle. Nirvachaniya. You heard that phrase before? Vacha. Nirvacha. The Jewish faith has some idea like that, even. That the name of God is so sacred, you can't utter it. We don't have the qualification to utter that which is so sacred, and so you can't address God by name because it's too sacred. And the Buddhists have this notion of nirvachaniya. Only they call it nirvana. It's so apart from our experience, it's not utterable because we speak within our experience, and so we can't take some sound vibration and utter it because it's beyond our experience. And what is that? It's nirvana. Void. How do you utter void? So nirvachaniya. Then he says, O great sage amongst kings, judge for yourself by thinking over all of this with your own intelligence. He's saying that you're a pure devotee. You're so intimately connected with Supersoul. Supersoul knows, therefore you must know. So why don't you say, what's the cause? Why am I suffering? In his commentary, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur invokes that there's this rule that sometimes applies, that when you list things in a string, the last one is most prominent. And so the last one should be taken as the conclusive one. Not always that rule applies, but in this case he says that rule applies. That it's not by speculation, but it's by intimate connection with the Supreme that one can know that which is otherwise not knowable. In the purport, Prabhupada explains, actually this is the philosophy or the principle that's accepted by Vaishnavas, which is that which is ultimately the cause of all causes is Krishna. Ishvara Parama Krishna Sachit Ananda Vigraha Anadir Adir Govinda Sarva Karana Karana. He is the Karana of all Karanas. So there may be some immediate cause of something. But behind that immediate cause of something, that's the effect of some prior cause. And that cause is also the effect of some prior cause, which is the effect of some prior cause. And the original cause is Krishna. So the Vedanta is searching for that original cause. Whatever is the original cause, whatever that is, that's the absolute truth, and anything else may also be true, but it's a relative truth relative to that which is dependent upon. And then the absolute truth has no cause. And that's what these six darshans are looking for. What's the original cause? So some say karma is, and some say that matter is, properties of matter. There's nothing but matter and the laws governing matter. So they call it physics or call it something else, but it's the laws governing matter. And that's it. And there's nothing more. And whatever is a combination of matter getting together with other types of matter according to the laws of matter. And that's what there is, and there's nothing else. That's their idea. The Bhagavatam is a different idea. Matter and the laws governing matter have a cause. Why there's matter and the laws governing matter and the supervision of those laws governing matter, like making sure the laws are followed, there's a superintendent, a upadrashta, and a anumanta, an overseer and a permitter. And that's Krishna. Upadrashta anumanta cha. Both are described in the 13th chapter of Bhagavad Gita. And that entity, that's the cause of all causes. That cause of all causes entity is not obliged to follow any rules. He makes the rules and he can break the rules. And he enforces the rules. And if there's a lifting of the rules, he decides it. He's not deriving his permission or potency or sanction or anything, his existence, from any other source. So the Dharma is concluding, because you're intimately connected with that source, you must know what's the cause of suffering. There's a very nice historical piece of information for you to know. Jiva Goswami. You know who Jiva, anyone not know who is Jiva Goswami? One of our six Goswamis. There he is on the altar. The six Goswamis of Vrindavan. He was the nephew of Rupa and Sanatan Goswami. That is to say, Rupa and Sanatan had a third brother whose name was Anupam. Anupam had one son named Jiva. Because Jiva was very young and his father expired when he was still very young, when Rupa and Sanatan went to Vrindavan, he had to stay at home with his mother until he was old enough to move around and go about. So when he was of age to travel, he went to Navadvip, the place of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's childhood pastimes, and there he was met by Lord Nityananda. And Lord Nityananda gave him a tour of all of the places of pastimes of Lord Chaitanya in Navadvip. And that's recorded in Navadvip Dham Mahatmya. And after giving that tour, ecstatic tour, very, very wonderful description of that experience, Jiva Goswami and Lord Nityananda, Lord Nityananda gave him two instructions. You should go live with your uncles, Rupa and Sanatan. But before you go live with your uncles, you should go to study under Vidya Vachaspati, who is now living in Benares, and he will teach you the Sad Darshans, along with the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. What's the Sad Darshans? We mentioned them already. They are, hold your breath for a moment, they're atheistic doctrines. Oh, I gotta go study atheistic doctrines. The purpose of having him learn atheistic doctrines from a Vaishnav was so that when he was mature, under the training of Rupa and Sanatan Goswami of the teachings of Lord Chaitanya, he would know what the arguments against bhakti were from those who were like most expert in arguments against bhakti and know how to refute them. So that when he was mature and he was writing treatises on bhakti, he would anticipate, he would write in such a way, he would state what bhakti is, he would give the scripture to support what he said, he would then give the purvapaksha, the argument against the statement he just made in the scriptural support. Some may argue from this doctrine, that doctrine, and then to that I reply. Even before the person asked the question, he asked the question and gave the response. It's a classic Vedic style of writing. But he was perfectly trained. Perfectly trained. But not just, you know, so he became an atheist, but he knew how atheists argue against theism. Two other examples of the same thing. When I was a baby bhakta in ISKCON, maybe, you know, a one-year-old baby bhakta, first year or two in Krishna consciousness, still the first year. So our movement was still very young, but Prabhupada had begun his translations of Chaitanya Charitamrita. Now, we had very clear understanding from him that he was strongly desiring to complete all 10 cantos of Srimad Bhagavatam. We knew how many volumes, 60 volumes of so many pages, because Prabhupada had it all laid out in his mind. But he also wanted to make sure that we understood who was Lord Chaitanya and the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. So even before one of the first books I received was Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. And I started to read Teachings of Lord Chaitanya, my head spinned because it's very heavy, very weighty. So I was happy reading Bhagavad Gita. But Prabhupada didn't just want Teachings of Lord Chaitanya. Those are the Teachings of Lord Chaitanya has five sections, and it's the five main sections where Lord Chaitanya, from Chaitanya Charitamrita, is giving teachings. He gives teachings to Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya. He gives teachings to Ramananda Roy. He gives teachings to Sanatana Goswami. He gives teachings to Rupa Goswami. These sections of Chaitanya Charitamrita, where Lord Chaitanya is instructing, are what teachings of Lord Chaitanya is. It's the philosophical section. And Prakashananda Saraswati. So when Prabhupada came to that Adi Leela, chapter 7, it's Lord Chaitanya speaking with Mayavadi numero uno in the whole of the land, a sannyasi that had hundreds of thousands of other sannyasis who looked up to him as, you know, Mr. Impersonalist, expert in Shankaracharya's teachings. And the dialogue between Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Prakashananda Saraswati was translated by Srila Prabhupada, and it was such an important message that he wanted us to receive that he published it first in a paperback version, then he had it published in just one chapter, a hardcover version, and then he had it published again in another hardcover version. He wanted us to know, in the course, for our own protection and edification, and perhaps to help other people who may have been exposed to impersonal teachings, to be able to understand Lord Chaitanya's teachings as Lord Chaitanya had this dialogue with Prakashananda Saraswati, at the end of which Prakashananda Saraswati accepted bhakti. He became Lord Chaitanya's disciple. And then following him, all of his sannyas friends became disciples of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. But Prabhupada wanted us to know what are the arguments that may be against devotion and come to the position of clarity of why devotion. Why, just like at the program at IIT yesterday, the other day, whatever it was. One of the students that came up afterwards, I shared this with Rajiv, he came up and said, "This is my first time here and I'm an atheist." And he looked at me like, you know, to see how I was going to react. Like, you know, just, well, you're an atheist, get out of here, just dismiss you. But I didn't do that. And so, no, let's have some discussion. Why are you an atheist? He said, my friend asked me the same question. And that's one of my reasons for it. So we went down the path of discussing. And at the end, he said, I'd like to buy a copy of your Bhagavad Gita. I have a copy of Bhagavad Gita at my home, and I read it. I'm an atheist, and I read Bhagavad Gita, but I get an atheistic conclusion out of reading Bhagavad Gita. I said, who's the author? He said, I have the same question. It doesn't even show it in the book. Or the translator, rather. Say, maybe it's a group of scholars that got together and wanted to put you under a whammy. He said, oh, maybe. So, but I'd like to read your Bhagavad Gita. What you're saying is appealing. But, you know, I'd like to look at it carefully. Okay. Do we have Bhagavad Gita's there?
Yeah, but we can get
it. Huh? Do you know who I'm speaking about?
No, I don't.
Mm-hmm. A young fellow with glasses.
Okay.
Very thin. Mm-hmm. He said his roommate comes to these programs. That's why he came. Okay. We should have books at the programs. Another example, I'll go back to the text here, but twice that I'm aware of in the VIHE, in these month-long classes, the title of the course that was given was Defeating Mayavad Philosophy. So the first half of the course was very carefully spoon-feeding what does Mayavad philosophy say. Because you have to know what it says before you can find where the flaws in it are. Same approach that then the other half is, here's the response to that idea. So be very clear what the statements are. Just like the approach that Sariputta took in addressing views of modern science. He would present very clearly, this is the view of modern science. And then he would pour water into that view and watch where all the water was leaking out. Look at that hole, look at that hole, look at that hole. There's another hole, look at that hole. So many holes. Whoa, look at that big one. Well, maybe it could be answered this way, but then that's not an answer because. And maybe someone might say that, but that doesn't hold water because. It's a hole. And there's a hole in the bucket. There's a lot of holes in that bucket. Now, let's look at another bucket. Another model of looking at the same phenomenon. And it's much more reasonable, this other one. It doesn't have these holes. That's an approach that Sariputta would use. It's the voice of reason. When dealing with people that don't have faith, perhaps because, like Dharma is expressing here, this is Dharma. This isn't like, you know, John Doe. This is Dharma saying, it's hard to discern. Now, why doesn't he know? He's Dharma. He's got to know. If he doesn't know, who knows? And the answer is explained in the next purport. Actually, he knows. But he's put in that situation, not only the situation of not knowing, but Dharma has his legs broken? Wow. Why didn't Krishna intervene? What's going on here? The answer, we'll say it and then we'll come back to it again. The answer that Prabhupada gives is connected to this verse also. Those who are of the opinion that even you know that there's a remote cause, an ultimate cause of all causes, why would God permit or cause suffering for Dharma? It's inexplicable. And then Prabhupada refers to Bhishma Dev, who says the same thing. Bhishma Dev said the same thing in Bhishma Parva, or in the Bhagavatam Canto 1, Chapter 9. He speaks to Maharaj Yudhisthira and says, who can say what is the plan of the Lord? He's the cause. But what's the purpose of the way events unfold in life? It's inexplicable. Who can know except the Lord Himself? But we do know that He wanted this to happen. It was very clear He wanted the battle to happen. And you are just an instrument of His will, so the outcome is in His hand. The activity of a devotee is as an instrument of the will of the Supreme, and the outcome of that activity is in the hand of the Supreme, provided we're being fit, usable instruments. After saying that, like nobody can know, then Prabhupada says, here was the plan of the Lord. In this circumstance, it's both Dharma and the cow representing the personification of earth, or mother personified, and religion personified. So here is the person, here's Maharaj Parikshit, confronted with this inexplicable event. What Krishna wanted to do was show, just see the qualification of Maharaj Parikshit. He knows all three of these things: how to address Dharma, and how to restore the legs of Dharma. He knows how to address Mother Earth so that she's pacified and in turn is properly protected. And he knows how to address the personality of Kali, the perpetrator. He's good. That was Krishna's plan. So we can see the greatness of Maharaj Parikshit. By his action, the legs of Dharma were restored. And by so doing, it shows us how we can, in our lives, address a situation where principles of religion are simply being grossly violated, and what to do. Because we're faced with the same situation as Maharaj Parikshit. The influence of the personality of Kali, the age of Kali, is acting on the lives of people all around us, maybe even in our own lives. The attack of the personality of Kali is very strong. What to do? How to address principles of religion, how to address mother, cow, and how to address the perpetrator. That's Krishna's intention, Prabhupada discloses. That is otherwise, by the personality of Dharma, undiscernible, inexplicable. Supposing we're not Krishna conscious yet, supposing the assembly of devotees, maybe one or two of you aren't pure devotees yet, maybe that's the case. So, what's the consequence of that? If we're seeing some perpetrator of some wrong against us, simply that alone, and as a result of being so fixed upon that, we're not seeing behind it what's the remote cause. We're not seeing the hand of God. We're not saying yes to Krishna, we're saying no to the instrument. Then we become implicated in the material energy. There's three things. This is an important lesson. This is a take-home item for all of you. in the seventh canto, first chapter, there's a nice verse where it describes something that's not within our experience, but it's easy to understand. The example in the verse is given of a bee that's chasing a grassworm, and the grassworm's in a hole. And the grassworm hears the bee coming. So he's hiding in his hole looking. And the verse says, by his meditation upon the bee, in his next life he becomes a bee. From grassworm to a bee. And similarly, if one sees the instrument of one's suffering and simply meditates upon the instrument of one's suffering as the perpetrator, what happens? You become the perpetrator. The victim becomes the perpetrator. It happens in life all the time. The mistake is not seeing what's behind it and just seeing the problem. Another example is the instruction the Prabhupada gave. So maybe some of you have gone to the Festival of Inspiration in New Vrindavan. Every year Peter Burwash comes, the tennis pro and instructor of leadership principles. But he had some nice association with Prabhupada, and he tells a nice story that he gave some money to the temple as a contribution, and the next day the temple president ran off. It was like $500, which, you know, during those times for a young guy getting started in business was a lot. And maybe it wasn't the treasurer, the president was the treasurer. Somebody ran off with his money. And he was very unhappy. And he mentioned this to Prabhupada. Prabhupada the answer that Prabhupada gave surprised him, but satisfied him completely. Prabhupada's answer was, this is very bad, but from your side, what he did was bad, but from your side, don't become absorbed in meditation upon the wrongdoer. Never blame the instrument of your own karma. Interesting. Prabhupada gave a similar answer to Bhakti Tirtha Swami. I'll do it quickly. This is instructive. So how we can understand when a problem is there, how do we see the problem? I'll do it rather quickly. Bhakti Tirtha Swami was a huge success person in college. A young black Afro-American in Princeton University in full scholarship during the time when Martin Luther King was shot, you know, where black people were not treated properly. And it was during that period of the civil rights movement of Martin Luther King that qualified institutions like Princeton University were obliged by government edict that they were to give free education to qualified students from communities that couldn't afford it. So he was qualified and he got a full scholarship. And he had straight A's, and he was the president of his class, and he was the president of the Afro-American society, and, you know, during my college days, that was a big movement in the college campus. You know, people becoming aware of the history of Africa and the Africans now in America, the Afro-American history. He was the president of that. He was a leader with great respect of all the population of all the other students. But in the course of those years when he was in college, I came to find this out later. We had set a little Sankirtan party from the New York Temple, and they went to different campuses, and one of those campuses was Princeton University. He got a book. He got a book, and he read the book. And he was so excited by the spiritual message, the purity of that message, that he decided he wanted to meet the person who wrote this book. So he started following the thread and found out that Prabhupada was visiting in New York, and he came to meet Prabhupada, and he was overwhelmed. So he decided all of that success, he could have been, you know, worldly-wise, extremely successful. And he left all of that just to be at Prabhupada's feet. But then in his association within ISKCON, he had some unhappy experience, and that unhappy experience was even within the spiritual organization, there was racial prejudice. And he was very surprised, because the teachings are this, and the behavior is that, not consistent with the teachings. So the first time he had an opportunity to directly speak with Prabhupada, he was in Prabhupada's room, he was very nervous, but he wanted to be, you know, direct. And so he told Prabhupada, when he had the opportunity to do so, that in your organization, Prabhupada was appreciating the service that he had done for him. And he shared with Prabhupada that in your organization there's racial prejudice. And Prabhupada gave a very similar answer. That is, this is not very, that he gave to Peter Burwash. This is not very good. But if you become disturbed by that racial prejudice, you know better than they are. If you're on the platform of bodily concept of life, because somebody else is on the platform of the bodily concept of life, you're getting drawn into that bodily concept of life, you know better than they are. When you're on the receiving end of injustice, and you just stay on that material platform of the injustice and don't rise above it, you just got sucked into being implicated in the same wrong thing as they are. The wrong thing is bodily consciousness, not spiritual conception of life. So, after hearing what Dharma has said, Maharaj Parikshit is very happy. And he says to the bull, "Oh, you are in the form of a bull. You're not simply a bull. You're the personality of religion, because nobody could give an answer like this. You know the truth of religion. Although you're saying that you don't, you know the truth of religion. Because you're very carefully avoiding this mistake that those who don't know the truth of religion fall into. And that is, the mistake is identifying the perpetrator of your suffering and thereby holding ill will towards the perpetrator of your suffering. You're not doing that. Because you're on a higher plane of consciousness. You understand remotely there's the Supreme. This wouldn't happen without this. Nothing happens without the sanction of the Supreme. And so you're not wanting to blame the Supreme. He's the cause of my suffering. You're not on this plane. You're not... You're accepting that if something comes your way, somehow there's a plan of the Lord. And if I can serve the plan of the Lord, what greater happiness can I have than serving the plan of the Lord? Now, knowing what the plan of the Lord may be difficult to know, but I accept that there's some sanction of the Supreme, otherwise it wouldn't be happening. So let me concern myself with that plan of the Lord and say yes to the plan of the Lord and execute it. But I can't know unless the plan of the Lord is disclosed to me, unless I become so near and dear to the Supreme, or one who is near and dear to the Supreme, they can disclose it to me. So let me work on my own purity. That's the conclusion of a devotee. Here's how Prabhupada explains. A devotee's conclusion is, this is deep. You know, to act on this platform, but that's what the Bhagavatam is teaching us. A devotee's conclusion is that no one is directly responsible for being a benefactor or a mischief monger without the sanction of the Lord. And, therefore, he does not consider anyone to be directly responsible for such action. It's not that, you know, somebody's beating you on the legs and you're asked, you know, who's beating you on the legs? Oh, I don't know. So you, if there is some, that it's not a wrong on the devotee's part to identify, in fact, there's some wrong, and here's the individual that's responsible for that wrong, that what's the error is to not see what's behind that, and what's behind that, and what's behind that. If we just look at the immediate circumstance, we're sucked into the material energy of cause and effect. And then feelings that go with that cause and feelings that go with that effect, or towards the cause and about the effect. We're being advised in this little section to be Krishna conscious. And what's the perspective of Krishna consciousness? Both cases, benefactor or mischief monger, he takes it for granted that either benefit or loss is God sent, and thus it is his grace. In case of benefit, no one will deny that it's God sent, but in the case of loss or reverses, one becomes doubtful about how the Lord could be so unkind to his devotee to put him in great difficulty. You know, what to speak of Dharma having his legs broken, and the cow feeling unprotected, unsafe, completely. Look at this madman running around with his club. And that's the age of Kali. Mad people running around with these very powerful tools called technology, just, you know, ripping earth apart and asunder, wantonly, recklessly, destructively, even hurting themselves. They're mad. Why can God let this happen? It's the age of Kali. There's one place in the purport of this section where Prabhupada raises the question and then answers. Maharaj Parikshit was smart. He knew Dwarapa Yuga's over, Kali Yuga has begun, and here's the guy. Finish him, and Kali Yuga's over. Simple. And there he's got the sword, he's got the ability, he's got just cause, he's breaking the legs of a bull. He doesn't do it. Why doesn't he do it? I mean, there's some intermediate things. Very cleverly, the personality of Kali surrenders. We're going to hear some more about that this evening. So it's the duty of a king to accept those who surrender unto him. That here's my white flag truce. I did some bad things, but I surrender. I'll be good now. I'll be clean. Spare me. You don't kill that person who comes up with the white flag. It's not codes of chivalry, codes of Kshatriya conduct. But a deeper reason is, Maharaj Parikshit understood, this is the age of Kali. So I can't interfere with the Lord's sanction that there be this age of Kali by killing Kali. I can't do that. So that also checked is destroying the person. But there's consequences of that, not killing the person. So much suffering. So many people in big trouble. But the how to, without pure devotion to Krishna, we can't be on the platform of acting according to the will of the Lord. We're at best in a mixed position where we see the interests of the Lord, but we also see our own interests, our own emotions, our own sense of right and wrong, our own sense of what do we do when we see some wrong. You know, all of our own little inscripted codes of how to act. This little section is very important, very powerful. It's helping us to see the path of how to get to another position, at a more Krishna-conscious position. At the end of this, Maharaj Parikshit doesn't put down his sword. He's ready to finish the personality of Kali. But he's respecting the speaker as being very, very wise He's not identifying the perpetrator directly, but it's also very clear. He's not implicating himself in the equally to blame. That's how Prabhupada describes it. For a devotee, the identifier is equally a sinner, like the mischief monger. Again, if that means if we see the instrument separate from the cause or the person that's moving, the wielding the instrument, or the cause behind that instrument. Like this example of Prabhupada speaking to Bhakti Tirthaswami, that the problem is the bodily conception of life. So someone has this variety or that variety or another variety of the bodily conception of life, all are flawed or problematic because it's the wrong conception of life. And you're going to have problems no matter how you move about if you're in the bodily conception of life. So that's the root problem. This particular manifestation or that particular manifestation, they may be less pleasing, but it's equally problematic. And the antidote is rise above the bodily conception. And then when you're above the bodily conception, you can act appropriately upon the circumstance. Otherwise, you're reacting on the platform of bodily conception. By God's grace, the devotee tolerates all reversals. Reverses. Prabhupada uses that word, reverses. Meaning, it's a big surprise. Say you're driving in your car and you're going through an intersection. The next thing you know, you're going in the opposite direction, although you didn't put the car in reverse. That's what he means by reversals. You're going along in life, padoop, 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 and all of a sudden, you're going in the opposite direction. What happened? Reverses. Unexpected, complete change of circumstances and dynamics, and how do you process that? It happens. Hey, the crash of the economy has affected a lot of people. Going along boop-a-doop-a-doop, and the next thing you're going the other direction. How do you process that? Or you have a relationship with someone and everything is going along fine. Next thing you know, it's something happened. What happened? I don't know what happened, but something happened and it's just completely going in another direction. It's out of control. Wait a minute. What do I do? Etc. Life has its reverses. Now, how does a devotee process? They don't just look at the immediate, they look at the remote and the ultimate. There's something of Krishna's sanction here. There's something in my relationship with Krishna to be understood and deepened, and some lesson of life to learn, etc., etc. And let me stay focused on that. Then I'm not just reacting to the immediate circumstance. Either, you know, defensively, I didn't do anything. Why are they dealing with me like this? Or then blaming, you know, that's just proof this person is blah, blah, blah. Whatever. And maybe a longer duration, not just, you know, an event, but like a series of events, or like a long period of, it's all falling apart. So then, you know, maybe it's in my chart. Rahu is conflicted with something or something like that. I don't know what all those things are. Must be my, I have to go see my astrologer. In In other words, a devotee has no suffering at all. Remember that. A devotee has no suffering at all. Because so-called suffering is also God's grace for a devotee who sees God in everything. The cow and the bull never placed any complaint before the king. He didn't, you know, like, you know, send out a complaint box. He came right there and said, "What's the problem?" Hard to say what the cause of all this is. My legs hurt, but it's hard to say what the cause is. The extraordinary behavior of the bull made the king conclude that the bull was certainly the personality of religion, for no one else could understand the finer intricacies of the codes of religion. So what's this finer intricacy? Let's summarize and conclude. Some very nice points here. There's levels of understanding duty, or what is to be done. And ultimately, the purpose of properly performed duty, if it's properly, to the degree to which a duty is properly performed, should be measured by how much one becomes attached to the personality of Godhead. That's the goal, to become attached to the personality of God. And if that which takes us to that, that's religion. That which takes us away from that is irreligion, whatever the name may be. Whatever ism it may be called. So, when we're deciding how to understand a situation that life brings our way, our foremost thought should be attachment to the personality of Godhead. In the morning Srimad Bhagavatam section that we're reading from, it's Devahuti being entrusted to Kardava Muni, because Swayambhuva Manu takes her there to the hermitage of Kardava Muni, because Devahuti has never met Kardava Muni because he's off in the forest. She's in a palace. But she's heard about his qualification, and when asked by her father, "Who would you like to marry?" it's Kardava Muni. So Swayambhuva Manu takes Devahuti with him to meet Kardava Muni, and when he agrees, there's many nice points, that the exchange is very wonderful, but when he agrees on the basis that he accepts this as the plan of the personality of Godhead, Lord Vishnu. And as soon as, so he says that specifically, and I'm following the plan of the personality of Godhead, Vishnu. And it's his plan, because it was already disclosed to him. The personality of God had showed himself to him in person before Kardava Muni, and spoke to him and indicated this was going to happen, that he would have as a child a very qualified son, an incarnation of himself. So this is the Lord's plan. He accepted. Although his life is one of complete detachment from anything worldly, he's accepting this arrangement, which is a worldly arrangement for the plan of the Lord. The verse we read then says, as soon as he finished speaking, because his mind was already absorbed in Lord Vishnu and the Lord Vishnu's plan, his thoughts were completely and now in silent position, silent about what his service was. All that was left was his meditation upon Lord Vishnu. And he was smiling very charmingly, like radiating this blissful smile, just thinking about Lord Vishnu. Seeing that smile of Kardava Muni, Devahuti was enchanted, and her mind was fixed upon her husband, whose mind was fixed upon, or husband-to-be, was fixed upon Lord Vishnu. And this is the way of devotion. So whether it's fortune or mischief, we don't, it's not like we, you know, it's mischief behavior is fine because it's the plan of the Lord, and you know, it's not that devotees are dull. or unable to discern things, and we don't feel anything because we're just supposed to be these neutral, zombie-like personalities. Mm-hmm. But we don't merely identify with the immediate set of circumstances, which are flickering, temporary, they come and they go. We see more deeply the interest of the personality got it, and depending upon our circumstance and our duty and so forth, we act appropriately in service to the personality of Godhead. But happiness and distress based upon events and circumstances is not the life of devotion. We discern, we act appropriately, but we're not simply reacting and blaming and faulting and celebrating and the world of the temporary. There's a deeper principle of Dharma that the Bhagavatam wants to bring us to again and again and again. Any discussion? Questions?
Maharaj, long time back I heard one of the devotees saying that Krishna Bhagavad said that before we transcend the dualities of happiness and distress, we have to undergo the emotions of them before you transcend them. So I'm not sure whether she said that, but is it a correct statement?
Before we can transcend, we have to undergo
the emotions, the dualities.
Well, that's where we are. It depends, on how it was expressed and what was meant by the expression. But, the fact of it, it's not that one has to, like Daksha gave a false argument. The false argument of Daksha was, my sons have to undergo suffering before they can transcend. You have to know what is suffering before you can transcend suffering. And that's not so. But that we have to, we are in a position of exposure to dualities, and from Ishopanishad, the verse is there that says one should become the knower of both vidya and avidya in order to transcend. It's like this other expression of what impersonal teaching and personal teaching, or the satdarshans and devotion. Because otherwise, if we don't know, we might mistake one for the other.
So we should know that, but should act upon that. Or not able to...
If we're going to dismiss, it's like you're growing a garden. You have to know what the desired plants are, you have to know what the weeds are, because when you start pulling out weeds, you want to make sure you're pulling out weeds and not the desired plants. So we're cultivating a creeper of bhakti. We have to know what emotions are centered upon Krishna and appropriate, what emotions are in illusion and not appropriate for a life of devotion. We have to address them. Yes.
Thank you. The discussion on the analog devotion.
Yes.
If a devotee gets into some misery, some problems, do you think as a devotee we need to pray Krishna or not to pray Krishna? The reason is, it says, I read somewhere in Bhagavatam that if demigods, devatas are in trouble, they still go to Vishnu asking for help. So they are called Sakama Bhaktas. So in that case, if I want to transcend, I'm not in that state, but I want to, still I'm a Sakama Bhakta. Can I really go and ask Krishna? Because if the pure devotees are, they don't even think about that, they don't even ask Krishna, they always think, this is because of my past activities, past deeds, so I'll do my service to Krishna. So I don't have that strength to think about, so how should I go?
Well, a short answer is, dependent upon faith, that's what you should do. dependent upon faith, you should be guided. And in fact, you should guide others. And you should conduct your life, knowing what your stage of matured faith is. So, your question is, should you pray for mitigation of some difficult circumstance? If your stage of spiritual evolution is such that that particular circumstance is just consuming your attention, that's a description of the stage of one type of stage of evolved spiritual consciousness. And in that particular, I can't think straight. The circumstance is so disturbing. So then one can certainly pray to Krishna. Please help me address this disturbing circumstance. Not just like remove it, but help me address it. It may be that my stage is just remove it. Now whether Krishna will or not is another thing. But according to faith. And as faith evolves, or we can say Krishna consciousness or Krishna bhakti, because they're different terminologies of practically the same thing, as Krishna bhakti becomes more developed, then we find this nice expression in second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Krishna says, tolerate. And then he says, rise above. Tolerate, rise above is beyond tolerating. And then where your consciousness is so far fixed upon Krishna, the circumstance is not disturbing anymore. It's going on, but it's not disturbing anymore. Depends on what to do, whether to pray or not pray, or you know, what to pray for. It depends upon state of consciousness or the condition of faith.
So that again, the situation now in this recession, say people are losing jobs, say I lose job.
Sure.
And then the immediate circumstance, what I can think about is, yeah, this has happened to me, this has happened to everyone, it's global. But still, how should I survive? So I should pray Krishna. I am depending on the mercy of the Lord, but do I think, you know, in that case, still I am a Nishkama Bhakta, or I don't want to be, but at least I will go towards a Nishkama, but still am I a Sakama in that case?
You know, my answer doesn't change from what you just said. So I'm looking within myself, and my realization is, I'm not on this other platform. So therefore, let me approach Krishna according to the platform that I'm on, so I can continue to be peaceful in my progression of Krishna consciousness. But another person may be, because we're going on hypothetical things, so another person may be on the position of, I trust that Krishna is going to make some arrangement. I'm going to be diligent, but I'm not going to offer a prayer to Krishna. My prayer might be, that person's prayer might be, Krishna, this is a great opportunity to simply be focused upon your lotus feet and dependent upon your lotus feet. Please help me keep my mind throughout all of this circumstance just upon your lotus feet. And that's the prayer, not please give me a job because I have to take care of. So it depends on the premise that you described is that person sounds like he needs to pray to Krishna, please help me find a job, because my duty is to take care of my family. You know, it's a sakama position of King Chittaketu when he wanted a son. Now his argument for wanting a son was, it's my duty as a king to provide successor to the throne, so I require a son. But the real deal was he was attached to having a son. You know, it was a nice smokescreen, but the real thing was he wanted that happiness of fatherhood. And it wasn't happening. It wasn't the sanction of the Lord. That's sakama, and he got his sakama, but he got a punch in the nose at the same time. Whoa. He got a lot of suffering so that he could understand sakama isn't right. Yes.
Basically, I've seen it depends on the perceptions we have, the conditionings we've had. So when we look at a particular circumstance, the perspective we get is something from the past that we've known.
In the conditioned state, that's a fact.
Right. And so I'm thinking that there are times, situations where we may know the spiritual conception, or you know, we may be aware that this is the way things.
But
we feel a little bit pinched, or and I feel that if I don't stand up for the feelings that I'm that are evident to me, then I'm not validating myself. So how do I kind of, you know, balance these two?
Same answer. Look at your, in addition to the feelings and perceptions due to my conditioning, also take a look at your faith. Put a little faith barometer in your system and find out what shows. What's the reading? Is it my faith that I must do that? It's not so. Say it differently. Is it possible for someone who has strong faith? The answer is yes. Is it possible for someone who has strong faith to look at a circumstance that's challenging? They know what the transcendental standard is. They're also feeling these pushings and pullings from their conditioning. Based upon faith, I can transcend that pushing and pulling. It's not artificial. And so they go with that. That's this tongues to tiksha subharata. Chapter 2. You tolerate it. It's like, I've got an itch. So now, am I going to scratch the itch? Or maybe just, I don't even think about it, just scratch the itch. Maybe I think about it, I've got more important things to do than occupy myself with scratching itches. Am I being true to myself if I don't scratch that itch? Just place your consciousness in when that tolerance requires withdrawing your consciousness from asat and placing your consciousness upon sat. And with strength of faith, one can do that. When faith is not strong, then I have to be moving about in this world of duality, honestly recognizing I know what the higher standard is, I'm just not there yet. I want to be there, but my faith isn't sufficiently strong. You know, it's like, you know, somebody that's not chanting japa, and they're trying to decide, should they begin chanting japa? So let me think about chanting two rounds. Am I being honest to myself? I really don't want to chant japa. Although I know I should. It's the same principle throughout life. So at some point they say, I should. Even though there's this voice that says, you know, you don't have time, you don't really want to. Or whatever that voice is. This conditioning voice. But you just decide. And that faith is supported by not just, you know, recognizing that's just a conditioning, but it's also the strength that comes from good association and other forms of wholesome conduct, good association. You know, following through on something that you know and getting this realization, wow, there's all this strength. It's so powerful, that's so much more powerful than acting according to my conditioned nature. Faith can become nurtured. Then it's not, as you described, I'm not validating my own feelings. Let me recognize what those feelings are. Now, how am I going to deal with it? I may or may not. I may have an anger tendency. I don't want to be, you know, betraying my real feelings. I am angry! Now I feel better. I'm being true to myself. Instead of subordinating that which I know is not really what I want, although that inclination is there, I'm placing my consciousness on a higher level. And that's validating the higher self. Because that's in my real interest, it's who I really am. This other is a dream, it's illusion. It's my association with the modes of nature from the past, not who I am. Yes.
Seems like it addressed exactly the turmoil in my heart.
One of them.
Right now it's my
heart. Okay.
And I have one question related to that. If I know, yeah, you said we should accept everything as a plan of Krishna, but when we're going through a situation that's difficult to understand what the next step, we accept the immediate situation as a plan of Krishna, it's difficult to understand what the next step in the plan is from Krishna. And if I see, in the sense, for example, if I see something that's wrong, my first reaction or my reaction to my heart is that I should try and correct that wrong so that...
What if that's Krishna's service, not yours? What I just spoke is a lesson that I learned from Bhurijan. I appreciate my relationship with Bhurijan more than he knows. And one time we were in Vrindavan together. It's a very memorable circumstance. I was sharing with him, you know, in confidence, here's something that is going on, and it's, you know, it's troubling my heart that this circumstance is going on. He didn't say, don't do anything, but he did share that sometimes there are circumstances that it's just between that individual and Krishna. Now, again, he didn't say, don't do anything, but allow that's one of the choices, the options. And so if I honor that Krishna may be acting in this individual's life in a particular way, they have a very unique relationship with Krishna as Krishna's devotee, and, you know, for years or some duration of time they've been acting in devotion, and now there's an obstacle for them, or they're stuck somewhere. It's not necessarily my service to get them unstuck. I should be their well-wisher, for sure. But it may not be any direct action. Maybe so many things. Maybe just offering prayers, or just wishing them well. And wishing those involved in the circumstance well. It may be that I have something directly to do. But if I if I'm going to act, it should not be in the doer mentality. It should be the instrument of Krishna mentality, the humble servant of Krishna. Spirit. All the while being, as far as my capacity permits, tuned into what is that instrument of Krishna want for me? What does Krishna want of me in this circumstance? How should I best serve Krishna? In a humble mood. Then, you know, the reactive, by that I mean, you know, being caught in the duality of the circumstance, there's the problem, and now I'm the affected party or the observer of this, you know, wrong thing. And it hurts to see that other persons are affected or myself affected. Now, the reactive nature is just do something about it, because you can't just let this wrong thing go on. Then you're implicated in the material energy immediately, just by thinking like that. Whatever you do, even if it's like good action, you're implicated in the material energy. So try instead to stay on the service to Krishna platform, the humble service to Krishna platform. And there's many options in circumstances like that. I'm dealing with something on my thoughts are going to a circumstance I'm dealing with on a GBC level. And I just spent precious 40 minutes this morning discussing the following point. When we're witnesses of something that's wrong, how we respond may very well make the wrongdoer do more wrong. Because they're acting prompted by something, and we're not understanding what that is that they're prompted by. We're just reacting to that behavior. And the problem is something that they're reacting to. We're not addressing what the problem is, so we get into this combative position with the person who is acting wrong. And we're inflaming them to act more like that. Whereas if they're approached with seeking understanding of, can you share with me your understanding of what's happening here? Then, you know, we can get to the root of the as an instrument, a root of the situation. Conflicts, it's this whole, the discussion was with Vrajabihari, but conflict, because he has a master's degree in conflict resolution. We're discussing this person and one side and that person. They're actually their natures are very similar, and they're very ethical people. But when treated harshly, they react. And then when treated harshly, the other one reacts. And so now they're in this conflict situation where they both agree on things they don't like. But now they're in conflict with each other. What is it that this one is unhappy with? What is it that one is unhappy with? And address that. Then they can be happy with each other. Right now we're just addressing the conflict that's between them without even addressing the thing that's behind. Try to understand the other person. There's a principle of communication. Real simple one. First, seek to understand. Then seek to be understood. Very simple. Yes. Yes.
We understand everything is arranged by the will of the Supreme Lord, and yet, when you see, like, if it's a child abuse situation, for example,
okay.
Something is terribly bad.
Terribly.
then even though we based on this whole principle, we may try not to see this person, this person who is abusing, he's also doing according to whatever was Krishna's arrangement. But we cannot just.
That's right. The message isn't be idle, be a pacifist, be a numb dodo. That's not the message. But when you do act, it should be act. The action should be with a deeper consciousness than simply reacting. Another principle is to get onto the spiritual platform and stay there, see the soul. So the behavior is bad, like the Christian saying, hate the sinner but not the sin, hate the sin but not the sinner. So the behavior is very bad. And persons that engage in that behavior need to be dealt with properly. But not just, they smack, so you smack them back. That's not going to solve the problem.
But practically, you still need.
You have to take action. But it should be done with proper contemplation of everything. On a Krishna conscious platform, ultimately. See the whole circumstance and ultimately the remote. Hand of Krishna. So obviously something like that, they're not like what the personality of Kali is doing. It's not like Krishna sanctioned it, so I guess I should just let it happen. But when acting, one should strive. If not, be on the platform of Krishna consciousness, be on the platform of recognizing, be mindful of Krishna in the whole deal, the course of acting appropriately, and as is appropriate act. But you lose perspective on appropriate action when you get caught in reacting and the modes of nature, and you're implicated in the waves and the whirlpools of the material energy. And it's not a pleasant ride. Anyone else? Yes?
My understanding from this session is that whatever the activities we do is as per the Krishna's plan.
Well?
I think,
what if I hit you?
Then
just Krishna's plan.
Yes.
Okay. Boom. there's a sanction of Krishna, but not a plan of Krishna necessarily.
Oh, that means there's a difference.
Yeah, big difference.
So we can be different from executing the plan.
Excuse me?
Our activities could be different from the real
plan. Oh, sure. What does Krishna want? Sarva dharmam pridyaja, mamekam sharanam raja. We're doing something else.
That means we have the freedom.
That's right. And Krishna may sanction proper use or misuse of that freedom, that free will.
Doing something different from what is planned. Is this plan is going to be updated again?
The plan is going to be what?
Updated.
Updated?
Yeah.
Krishna's plan of surrender unto him doesn't get updated. Not version number 2. Well, the plan is a universal one. The universal one is surrender to Krishna. Mam ekam sharanam. That's the plan. Now, there's varieties of that plan. When you go to Krishna, there's varieties of things that you have as service to him. And in the course of going to him, there's varieties of service that you have for him. And there's varieties of the main plan. The main plan is return to Krishna.
And the plan is self-evident.
Well, you're using this very simplistic language, then I'll say a qualified yes. Because you take that simplistic language, then you can say so many other things that don't meet those qualifications. A qualified yes. There's a plan for everybody. Go back to Godhead. And then there is different... because we're all individual, there are different ways in which we can serve Krishna in our path back to Godhead. But service to Krishna in full surrender and love, that's universal. That's His will. Maybe we'll use the word will instead of plan. It's Krishna's will. He wants our love. He's not like unhappy, hanging out lonely. But for our benefit, He wants our love. So give Him your love. That's the plan. That's Krishna's will. His will is for your well-being, all of our well-being. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
You mentioned that if I become disturbed or I'm seeing some injustice or some injustice has been dealt to me, that we don't want to stay in that injustice because that will entangle us in bodily consciousness more.
Yes.
So, and for me, I have a very great tendency to either my mind spins on that same injustice or I tend to be do a mental adjustment to try and get out of that.
Okay, it's the glowworm program. The grassworm, excuse me. Remember the example? Krishna is your protector. In those circumstances, turn your attention, withdraw attention from that temporal picture and place your attention or your consciousness upon the Supreme. Even while that circumstance, practice coming back from that path and go down the other one. Withdraw consciousness over there and go over to Krishna. Practice. Just keep practicing. In fact, withdraw the mind and place over here. Consciousness upon Krishna. How can I serve Krishna? Even in this circumstance, how can I best serve Krishna? You invest consciousness like that and you'll get indications. From scripture, from your heart, from experience, from things that you've already heard, you just forgot because you're so absorbed in this temporal thing. Something will come, how you can best serve Krishna. And then you go down that path. And like the point that I made to Uchira, maybe just, you know, don't do anything on that particular point, recognizing Krishna will address this. If it's that kind of a circumstance, Krishna will address it. Or I can bring this to the attention of somebody who is in a position, relationship-wise, with that cause, to address the situation. Okay. Let us have some care time.